anybody listening to this and being like, oh no, I never recognized that my kid's smell was real and I ruined, I mean, like, one day at a time, take it easy on yourself. You know, whatever platitudes you want to insert here.
I love your hair. I love it. I love your freeness with it. Every single time I see you, I'm always like, I'm doing it. I'm going purple. Like, all I want to do is put lavender in my hair.
You're the toilet? Like, how did you end up being the toilet? But I approached it with curiosity.
Welcome back to Sensory Play Reimagined. This is a podcast where we explore how sensory play can help unlock your child's development and well-being potential. I'm Rachel Rothman. I'm your host. I'm a mom of three and I'm a toy expert. And today I am thrilled we have Dr. Hirschberg with us. She is a clinical psychologist and a parenting coach who specializes in helping families navigate the challenges and the joys of childhood development. I'm so glad to have you here. I will share with the audience before I let you introduce yourself. I have had the privilege of working with you both professionally as well as personally. So you know my family and my kids. So there might be a little shorthand there, and I will do my best to educate the audience on all the things that we're describing. But again, I could not be more thrilled. If there's any person who I want to talk about how play connects with the emotional and the social connection with children, it was you. So thank you. I'm so grateful that you are here. And yes, if you could quickly explain, you know, who you are, what your practice is, you know, just boil down the last 20 years of your life and your professional experience into like a 10-second snippet.
Oh, yeah. No big deal. So thank you, first of all, such kind words and such a delight to be here. So you certainly got a lot of it. I'm a clinical psychologist, a parenting coach, an author. I've written one book. I called it my first book for a while, and now I'm just calling it my book.
Stay tuned for more.
Exactly. Called The Tantrum Survival Guide. I'm a mother of two boys. One of them is 10, one of them is 8. And I kind of walk a fine line with them. I don't feel like their stories are mine to tell in public. And I think it's also fair to say that they are both neurodiverse in some way or another. And I think that's important information. And so I bring to the conversation a professional lens, but a mom lens as well.
I wanted to just butt in and say, I very much similarly to you, like, believe my children's story is their story to tell. And, you know, while I do share anecdotes about, I think, things that everybody can relate to, whether it's, you know, them getting in the bath and not really loving it or having difficulty at night, kind of things that are universal and I think people understand. I too have neurodiverse children, but let them, you know, at the age and stage what they're comfortable, I want it to be their story to tell as well. So I usually don't go into too much depth there as well, but similarly, my children would be identified as neurodiverse as well. So I likewise, when we're discussing this, have it through the lens of somebody who is speaking with all these amazing experts who has background with assessment and review of a lot of different products, as well as being a mom of three who have three very, very different profiles, as you know, and kind of the competing dynamics of what each of them brings to the table. And, you know, while something that I absolutely love about you, and we'll get more into this, is just like, it's very hard to parent perfectly and particularly in every single moment. And that isn't even a thing. You know, and nobody else is living my experience in this moment with my family, with my children, with our environment, with our needs, with our profiles and all these things. And kind of that expectation that you're just like, sometimes you're going to do a really great job and you're going to really try your best. And sometimes you might not have the bandwidth for it. And that's also okay. So we'll definitely get more into that later. But it's just something that, like, I hold with me. And on moments when I'm having a tough time, I remind myself kind of it's you in mantra form in my head. So I appreciate that. And I carry that with me. No. So I have a million questions to ask you, but as this podcast is focused on play, I will start there. And so beyond the fun factor, play can obviously be incredibly fun. How do you see it helping a child's emotional and mental well-being? And maybe we can start when they're like really, really young. How do you see that? And, or how would you tell parents to utilize play as a tool for helping to develop a child's social well-being or emotional well-being? That's a very loaded question, and I apologize. But
It's not a loaded question. What I was going to say is it would be much easier in some ways to answer its opposite. You know, how does play not help, right? I feel like play is development, right? I mean, play is foundational. Play is how young children explore, and exploration is how kids learn. So, you know, when people talk about, well, you need to, you know, have play as one aspect of kids' activity or one aspect of learning, it's like, well, no, it's actually much more, again, foundational is the word I would use. You need a foundation of kids who feel comfortable playing, exploring, and then the learning comes and the self-regulation and the social skills and all of that. I think play helps kids experience what the world is like. It helps them try on different hats. It helps them learn about math. It helps them learn about English. I mean, all these things that they wouldn't even know what it was. When I say math, I mean sort of like these two blocks are the same size as this one other big block, and I'm two. And I think parents sometimes view play as separate, or play as, you know, you have to interrupt for teaching moments, when in fact play itself is the ultimate teacher. I mean, again, your question is an excellent one, but I wouldn't even know where to start. It's from the general to the incredibly specific. Play is 100% necessary to develop in any realm you're discussing: social, emotional, academic, anything.
So maybe we can delve a little bit more into like a child who has slightly more specific sensory need, kind of sitting maybe a little bit on the fringe of, you know, what would be considered typical, you know, who have a bigger response to it. So again, I'm giving the instance of, I have a child who loud, big things is like too much for her. So how can you bring, are there any suggestions that you have maybe for helping to make play still something that is enjoyable and palatable, but not overwhelming and like too much? You know, like how do you keep them in the play if a child's having a hard time with it?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a couple things I would say. One is, I think your question kind of reveals a bias or a misperception that parents often have, which is that play has to be loud and boisterous. It's sort of like typical camp counselor play. You know, we're going to get in there and we're going to, you know, and it's like, oh God, no, you know, take it easy. And
I was that camp counselor. So sorry to all the kids who did not enjoy that. I've learned, I know better. And I agree.
So I don't think that's something that's true necessarily. And I would start from a step back, which is not necessarily if play becomes too loud and overwhelming, but sort of who is my kid and how can I stay attuned to my kid as we start playing, and notice what they're responding to and they're not responding to, and to take sensory needs into consideration. So if my child, let's say, starts crying, let's say young child, 2-3 year old, you know, it may be because of some sensory mismatch. I may be speaking too loudly. I may be speaking too quickly. The lights may be too bright. There may be too many toys out on the floor. You know, I think parents who are not well-versed in sensory information or knowledge, that wouldn't be where they would go to first. You know, it would be sort of, oh, what's, you know, is their diaper wet? Is there, you know, are they hungry? Do they hate this game? You know, and it may be, let's just slow down, speak more rhythmically, speak more softly, dim the lights, start with something really simple, like one or two blocks. That can be play. So I think I would encourage parents to open kind of their minds and think outside the box in terms of what play is, because there's nothing that would suggest that it would need to be loud or intense or a lot and 15, you know, stuffed animals out on the floor and 25 blocks and you're making a garage and you're making a veterinary hospital and you're making, you know, although there are kids that want that too.
Right. I like that concept of a sensory mismatch. And I think that that's like a really simple way and really clear way of like understanding it. I guess in my head, I think you know this about me, like we do all types of play. We do the quiet, we do the small, we do the big, and I am very aware of my kids' profiles. But I do have a child who likes it very loud, very big, very all the things. And then I have the one on the other end who kind of like retreats from that. And I won't call it necessarily a tantrum, a little bit older, et cetera, and, you know, more dysregulated. You'll get into the clinical terminology of what is appropriate, but in that sense. So now it is, you know, more of a group dynamic. They are playing together and they have very different needs and inputs. So what are some suggestions you might have in that scenario where it's like, I can't necessarily attune to both of them appropriately in the moment, but how can I still support the two of them?
Man, we're skipping ahead to the advanced class.
I'm sorry.
I'm just using this as a working session to work through.
Right. I gotta say, for all those parents who have two kids who have sensory needs that are completely different from each other.
Like, you have two children. In general, if you have more than one child, they likely are not always going to be in the same mode.
Of course.
So,
but that's where I really want to make sure for listeners that we're not overcomplicating things in some ways, because I think there can be a tendency when we use fancy words like sensory. That's sort of what you're asking is like, I've got two kids who are into doing different things and into different kind of play. How do I manage that?
Yeah.
And the answer is, I mean, I will give some specifics, but my first response would be like, I don't know, you figure it out, you play it by ear, you know, I mean, I just think what you said in the beginning about just not being too hard on yourself and not doing it perfectly, we kind of have to live that. And as a professional, I kind of, you know, tweak my answers around that idea. You know, it's not sort of like, oh, well, let me tell you the 10 things that pop into my mind, which I can, but it's also a very kind of Monday morning quarterback way to be. It's like, you know, this kid doesn't feel like being loud right now and this kid does. Well, then maybe you'd play loud with that kid while you let the other kid go to a quiet place, if there is one in your house, and do some craft activities, and then you switch off, or you throw this one into a beanbag 5 times to get that sensory seeking need met, and then read a book to the other one. And maybe it'll go great and maybe it'll all completely explode. And so it'll be snack time for everyone. You know, I mean, there's no formula for that. I think attuning to both doesn't mean meeting both of their needs all the time at the same time, which of course is impossible.
Right.
It's perhaps taking a moment to pause, to notice what's going on with each of your kids, and perhaps then to make a game plan for what feels like the priority. The kid who's having a hard time screaming is probably going to be more important to attend to than the kid who's having a hard time by just being kind of pouty.
Yeah.
Let's say, you know, so it's always kind of triage and thinking on your feet, which, you know, in my opinion and my experience is just practice. So a situation that might completely overwhelm you when it's the first, you know, you're a first time parent and your 2-year-old is, you know, having some sensory explosion, you've got a newborn baby and it feels like, you know, you're never going to get through this idea of being a parent of two, becomes easier.
Right.
Because you practice.
It is fun. It's something I like often say when grown-ups, when people are having, you know, like they've had their first child and then they're going to have a second one and they're like, you know, how do you do it with two kids? And it's like, you're a more experienced parent at the time at which you have your second child. You're no longer a first-time parent. And like, even once I had been two kids and I was having my third, you know, it every single time for me became easier. And I know that's not the case for everybody, but for me, the knowledge of like, we're going to have valleys, we're going to have hills, things are going to be hard, we're going to have these like moments where it feels like, okay, I kind of got it. That's going to fall down from under me pretty soon. But I know that we'll get back to a place of like relative homeostasis, and then something, you know, then the three of them will all get sick, and that, you know, like kind of like you
ride the waves. Yeah,
very much like waves. But I think that kind of meant, again, you always bring me, I sometimes go to the extreme place of like, you know, how do I fix a situation? And it's not always like the situation needs to be fixed. It's also like my mentality needs to be fixed, because that situation doesn't need to be, you know, I can address the situation of, in that particular instance that I was giving, that was hyper specific to my children, of one having the overload and the other one kind of, you know, needing something else. I can satisfy one and tell the other one I'm coming in a little bit. We can try to all kind of reorient to something that might be suitable for us. They could also both play independent. Like, there are a lot of different things that could happen in that scenario, that it's not like, one, I'm doing anything wrong, two, they're doing anything wrong, or three, it has to be fixed in that moment. And I, you know, reminding, again, good reminder to myself, that's all okay.
Mm-hmm.
Um, So thank you. Thank you again for that. I'm just personally using this for my own therapy.
Great.
Thank you very much.
A word from our sponsor, EduShake, the original sensory company. EduShake is a 40-year-old expert in child development toys that started by working as a trusted supplier of daycares and preschools. It has since expanded to support families and special education globally. It's been featured on the Today Show, New York Times, Cosmopolitan, Good Housekeeping, and more. Their toys are rated 5 stars by millions of consumers. Get yours today!
Okay, so let's take it back to maybe when they are younger and kids are, you know, at that 2 to 3, and how have you seen play? Like we've talked about this a few on some of the other episodes where they're kind of progressing in terms of their social interactions. Do you mind like kind of breaking that down a little bit? Like when kids first play, I think like one of the things I hear a lot of parents say is like, they're not playing well together. And it's like, they're two, they're not supposed to be like playing well together is like, you have this concept of a 10-year-old playing with a 10-year-old and they're interacting and
we're maybe not, you know, maybe preteen angst, who knows.
But do you mind kind of walking through what that progression might look like from a really young child? Just because I don't think that everybody has an understanding of like the kind of the gradation as kids mature and develop. Do you mind kind of walking through what that funnel looks like for parents?
Sure, sure. I mean, I think when we talk about play, you know, we can talk as early as, you know, 4 months when a child sticks out their hand. I don't know if anybody can see me, but like, and starts doing like this, you know, it's like they're playing with their fingers, like, oh, what are these? This is fascinating, you know, or they're reaching up and touching a mobile, you know, and kind of playing with what happens if I bang it a little bit. You know, I mean, this can be considered play. Again, play is, in some very fundamental way, exploration. And so any stage that your child is at, play is going to be a way that they are kind of pushing their edge, if you will, and kind of exploring what's new. And so for babies and really young toddlers, that's going to be their body. You know, their body is new. Making funny noises is new. Noticing that if they spit, it feels funny when it rolls down their chin is play. Interacting, you know, peekaboo, you know, then that idea of kind of playing with relationship, right? My mommy is not here when she's behind the handkerchief, and then handkerchief. What am I, 1825? Whatever, the bandana, the sweater, you know, and then suddenly she's back. And like, how amazing is that? And I, as a little one, am playing with, ooh, mom disappears and she comes back and she's locking eyes with me and smiling. And that relationship becomes primary in play. Then you hit, let's say, you know, real sort of hardcore toddler, 2, 2.5. And you have what's called, which many people are familiar with, parallel play, which is that a child might be very into, you know, a toy or a, you know, when I say toy, yes, it could be a toy. It could also be like a pot and a spoon. And there might be another child next to them that's also into a pot and a spoon, but they're not really engaging necessarily, or they're engaging for a moment and then they're not. And it's, again, I think a way too high an expectation that you would think your 2-year-old or even your 3-year-old is really playing with someone, collaborative play. But parents often kind of want that. Look what he's doing. And your kid is like, why would I look at what he's doing? I have a pot. Like, that's much more interesting. Then you get into pretend play and imaginative play where kids are taking on role. You know, there's a good guy and there's a bad guy and playing with things like power. Oh, and I should say that even before that, it's playing with cause and effect, right? All these amazing tools where you press a button and a noise happens, you know, or you pull a lever and a color light goes on, you know. And cause and effect play is also, you know, when I drop my food on the floor, my mom talks in a louder tone of voice, like, I'm going to keep playing around with that. Like, I'm exploring, I'm learning my power. Collaborative play really only starts, again, and these are all kind of averages, but, you know, in like the 4s and 5s. Yeah. That's when kids start maybe playing together on the playground or playing family. You know, I think it in daycare, my kids went to like a daycare preschool, and I want to say my older one came home playing family at 4-ish. Mm-hmm. And he said that I was like, oh, who were you in the family? And you know, this one was a dad, and this one, I think there were two dads and three moms or something, and he was the toilet, my son. And at first I said, understandably, like, huh, you know, first of all, I'm going off on a tangent, but when your kids are playing, like, it's so hard not to judge, like, what, you're the toilet? Like, how did you end up being the toilet? But I approached it with curiosity, and I was like, huh, like, tell me more. And it turns out, like, the toilet was the best part. Like everyone wanted to be the toilet. I don't know why. I didn't get into details. I think it had to do with the fun of, like, that they would kind of sit on you and make pooping noises, and that was hilarious. And, you know, but anyway, my fear that my son had been relegated to the role of toilet was unfounded, because it was
okay, but he was really at the top of the heap.
It's funny, as you were saying that, like, I was thinking through, like, oh, I love cause and effect. This now makes sense that I am a scientist who likes to just continue to explore. Like, I got to never leave playland, you know? And I think a lot of times as we become older, even, like, I feel like it ends even sooner. Like, is this, I mean, you obviously know this significantly better than I do, but I feel like play, like you said, is this foundational thing. It's fundamental. It's how they learn. It's how they grow. It's how they explore. Why are we doing less playing? Like, as kids are getting older, you know, and what are some ways maybe we could be, like, you have an 8 and a 10-year-old, you know, my kids are starting to age up. I have 7, 6, and 4. How do you as a parent continue to, like, create opportunities for continued play and learning? Like, is that something that you still prioritize? Is that something that you even think about anymore? Is that something you're mindful of as a parent yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. And some of it is very basic, and you can kind of read about it everywhere right now in the context of Jonathan Haidt's new book. But some of it is sort of the, you know, putting away electronics. And, mm-hmm. and that is often let's play, right? For my kids, frankly, who are active, energetic, it's very rarely let's put away your iPad and read. Right? It's let's put away your iPad and go outside and play catch or roll around or, you know. So I think play, especially where I live, which is not in a city, is going outside, especially now that it's May and the weather is nice. You know, it's like, let's get outside and let's, you know, or let's look for bugs or look for sticks or, you know. So I think creating opportunities to be in nature has a huge overlap with play. I think moments of play. Right. So I think about moments where, you know, I sneak up behind one of my kids and sort of grab him and start tickling. And, you know, it may last for if he's OK, of course, the consent. Right. If he's OK with the being tickled. But, you know, it may last for 35 seconds.
That's impressive.
But it's a smattering of play, or it's being playful. Right. It's adding kind of playfulness to your interactions with your kids. Humor. Connectedness. It may not look like let's go play for an hour on the floor with our toys,
right?
But there's play for all of us, hopefully all the time. I mean, there's play in couples, and I don't have my mind in the gutter with that, but just, you know, the way that we connect and kind of lightly tease each other in affectionate ways, or, I mean, all of that is play. It's enjoyment and exploration. And I do believe it's our definition of play can be wide. It, you know, it is kind of just playing with a state of being or, you know, sensory input or whatever. But I think there's this may or may not be tangential, but I think what we're both describing is letting play evolve organically. I find that parents sometimes really put pressure on themselves, again, to, like, create the perfect play and or to make play work, right? So how many times parents will be playing with their kids, and, again, back to really young ones, they've got the the plastic or the wooden animals, you know, and it's like, what sound does this one make? What sound does that one make? And again, if you're a parent who does that, you're, I'm sure, a terrific parent. Like, I did that a million times, but it doesn't also have to be every time. Like, our kids don't always need to be asked about what sound the animal makes and what color this is and what shape this is. And like, they are going to learn by playing the way that they want to play. And as they get older, they will learn the skills they need to learn, presuming they're, you know, you're sending them to schools that are doing their job. But it, I find that parents get very pressured about, well, we're just sitting here playing and we should insert some teaching into this. And it kind of kills it. You know, it's like, well, no, we're not playing. Now you're asking, right, now you're asking me all these questions, which are the same kind of tone that I'm asked at school or whatever, you know, and like, this isn't actually play anymore. Right. Just because there's toys doesn't mean it's play. And I think parents sometimes, you know, blend those two things together.
I have to say, as you were saying it, I was just looking at your hair, and we've had this conversation many times, and you can attest to this. I'm doing lavender. I love your hair. I love that. I love your freeness with it. Every single time I see you, I'm always like, I'm doing it. I'm going purple. Like, all I want to do is put lavender in my hair. All right.
Well, that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I forgot that as play. And every time I go to get it redone, and I get it redone, I don't do it myself, I usually text like one or two friends being like, I just want to make sure, like, I'm 48 years old. Like, it's okay that I'm spending the day getting my hair dyed purple. And they're like, do you love it?
I'm
like,
you love it.
I just love it. I look in the mirror and I'm like, this is so cool. And it doesn't really matter what other people think of it. So I gave a talk recently at the Y. It was professional development for preschool teachers at the Y in the city, at the 92nd Street Y. And someone asked, like, you know, just curiously, like, why purple? Like, why purple hair? What? And it almost seemed like they were inserting this level of seriousness into it. Like, is there a symbol? Is there? And I was like, not it's like my favorite color, and I just think it's awesome because I get to look in the mirror and have purple hair.
Yeah,
like, oh, okay.
All right. So this is me holding myself accountable. I'm going to do it, because like it's great. like 5 years that I've been saying it to you. Like, I really want to go purple. And
well, next time I see you, I will make that nothing less. And you can start. I started with. I mean, and it's actually toned down now.
I think I'll be the
tips. I started with, I think, one highlight, you know.
I've been thinking and dreaming about this for long enough. I'm doing it. All right. This is good. This is a good reminder to self. Do the things that bring you joy. And I think, I lose sight of that every now and again. Like, what are the things that bring me joy? And I know when I refocus on it, and I know it's like, it's obvious, like it's almost so obvious to say it, but like I have to remind myself, I need to do the things that I find enjoyable and playful, because then I'm a more enjoyable and playful parent too. You know, like mm-hmm. I am better able to parent when my body is calmer, when I am in better sense of regulation, when I have also taken care of like the soothing that my body needs. And it's funny, I wasn't as aware of my own things that bring me joy. Like I think I did them kind of innately because I enjoyed it it was kind of like road and I was doing it. But like when I stop and think about like, what are the things that really bring me joy? Like I love a bath. I love taking a bath, and I love reading a book in a bath. And my husband once bought me a waterproof book to read in the bath. That was a romance novel. So like romance novels, my thing, I love it. It's the only genre I read. I love being in the bath. I love reading my book in the bath, and he got me a waterproof book of romance novel to read in the bath. And it was like, yes, like you just spoke to my soul in such a beautiful way. And I'm looking at myself, I'm like, I'm already like more joyful even just talking about it.
And that's attunement, right? He was really attuned to you.
I hope my husband's listening to this. My favorite things my husband has ever gotten me, I can list them right now. He got me that book. He got me another book, which like I was actually surprised by, because it was not a romance novel, but it was a satire and history of math. And it was called Here's Looking at Euclid. Ha ha ha. It was very punny. And like I to this day, I keep this book on my bedside table. And if you saw the number of post-it notes in it, I'm like, this is so cool. Like it was just like this book was my jam, and I've probably reread it like 3 or 4 times. It's been a while since I've reread it, but like I'll go to the post-its and like go back on it. He gets me avocados like every so often, and like we keep avocados in our house, but like when he goes out of the way when we don't have avocados to get me an avocado, and he knows that I want the avocado, it's like very big, and same with cantaloupe. So like food for me is like a way into my heart. Mm-hmm. And then like again, like small things, but that are like really aware of, you know, where I'm at. So anyway, thank you, husband. I appreciate it. My birthday is coming up, which is why I dropped these hints for him. These are the things to do. Nothing big and grand. Just, you know, get me another waterproof book and we'll be good. Anyway, just a tangent, but it's funny as you, I think, relating it back to, you know, our kids and sensory, it's like, as I had children and I had children who had these different profiles and makeups and all these things, it made me recognize my own. It made me recognize my husband's, and also kind of the dynamic that I grew up in with my siblings. And it's like so funny now, my sister and I can have like these conversations where we are two very different people. And obviously as kids, we didn't understand it through the lens of like, oh, these things feel different to you. Like I knew we were different individuals, but particularly from a sensory perspective, there were certain things that she did that I was just like, you are gross. Like that is gross to me, you know? And I think it's actually very helpful for me, having been a sibling and having shared space with other people, to recognize like, how can I help my children interact together in a space that's like shared, as we were, you know, kind of describing having multiple kids in a scenario where they all have different needs and they all have different modalities.
Well, and I think once you recognize sensory as a thing, you see it everywhere.
Right.
You know, it's like that person is wearing sunglasses now. It's like barely light out. Well, for that person, you know, I mean, you sort of wreck it. Once you kind of are able to validate that everyone has different sensory needs, desires, difficulties, whatever, you know, everyone is kind of on a spectrum of that. Then you notice it and it becomes important. It's like, why is that someone's favorite restaurant? Because it's really loud, and that's how they focus best on a conversation, is when there's a lot of really loud noise around them. Oh my gosh, that is the worst restaurant. I can barely friggin' hear what you're saying. There's so much, you know, I mean, you just realize how we experience the world from a sensory perspective is very different, and figuring that out about ourselves, our partners, our kids is so valuable.
Is there anything, I know you're saying like it doesn't have to be so prescriptive, it doesn't have to be so forced, but are there certain things that you have adapted in your home, to your practices, to what you do with your children to support different sensory needs? Like, are there things that in giving examples?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in my practice, what I'll say is that I always take it into account. Again, I always ask about it. You know, it's rare that a parent would seek me out for if they know that their child is having sensory issues, because it's not my expertise. I'm much more about social emotional development. However, if someone is coming to me about what they perceive as social emotional development, I will always ask about sensory related issues, and sometimes can really help parents see patterns in that regard. And it may not rise to the level of needing an OT evaluation. It may be, isn't it interesting that this always happens when they haven't gotten outside to run around, for example, you know? And so just being kind of tuned into that as an important area of questioning and thinking about. In my own home, I mean, sure, my younger one is, I don't know if I would call him this anymore, which is interesting. I mean, he definitely needs a lot of physical input, but I would say when he was younger, I would have called him a sensory seeker. I don't know that I would quite use that term anymore. It's just always being aware of how much physical activity he's got, and making sure that he's not spending a whole day just lounging around, which he may even think he wants. I mean, not that I'm there to kind of override him, and I'm very careful about making sure our kids kind of know that they are the experts in what their own bodies need. But I will point out, that he hasn't been outside, and then he'll love. It's like he'll just go outside and like run and jump and slam. When he was younger, when he was in preschool, I think every morning we got one of those like Yogibo bean bags, and just we would just hurl him into it like 5 times in a row, hard. I mean, that was the other thing. We were working with an OT at the time, and I remember she was like, harder, harder.
And so we have the same routine in the morning and similar.
Yeah, it was like, but if you don't have that, right? If you don't have that, it's like, are you kidding me? Like, because we all have ourselves. We're all kind of egocentric. We use ourselves as a reference point. If like someone threw me that art into a beanbag, it would be awful, you know? Right. But the point is, that's not me, you know? And I remember it took my husband's strength. I wasn't even strong enough to do it.
I can't do it anymore.
So my husband would just like pitch him really hard into a beanbag, you know, however many times in a row, and he would light up. I mean, the best analogy that I ever heard with regard to sensory seekers is that they sort of come into the world or experience the world the way that we do when we are washing dishes with dishwasher gloves on. You know, which are supposed to keep your skin, you know, moist or whatever it is. And I know that for me, if I wear them for maybe max like 11 seconds, I'm like, oh my God, I can't freaking feel the dish. I can't feel anything. You know, I feel like there's an awful feeling. And I've had occupational therapists say to me that a sensory seeker kind of feels that way in the world until they, let's say, slam themselves into a wall or jump off something really high. These are the kids that look like risk takers. And then they kind of wake up. It's like, oh, I can feel now. Like now I can actually feel. And, you know, there's really similar helpful analogies for all different sensory profiles that help with, I think, something that's really important, which is that as someone who doesn't have that profile, how can we help understand someone who does? You know, what is language or what is an analogy that will help us get it? Once I understood that, I wouldn't get so frustrated or freaked out when Zeke would climb to like the highest part of the jungle gym, you know, and just want to jump off. And I would help him do it. I would say, let's do this in a safe way, right? As opposed to, you know, oh my gosh, are you crazy? That's dangerous. You know, whatever it is, it's like, because that's a need he has and he will actually be so much better regulated if we just do that a few times. Let's do it in a healthy and safe way. In a way that I wouldn't with my other son necessarily because he doesn't need it in the same way.
Right. I had to work on my poker face with my sensory seeker because like innately every single time my entire body would go into overdrive of like, you know, concern or fear or whatever have you. I mean, there have been a few plastic surgeon interactions with said child, but for the most part, we've taught you know, safety integration and other things as she's gotten older. But yeah, okay. So you said you could go on and on. I'm going to ask you to give. Can you give one more example if you don't mind? Because I do think that it was incredibly helpful. You know, if somebody has the child who really feels like they need the input, could you give kind of a parallel on the other side, like on the flip side and or language, like. I always find your language so incredibly helpful. And even just like the way in which you probe or ask, get them to understand it. Like that was something very poignant. Mm-hmm. You just said that kind of, you know, it got a little bit glossed over, but I would love if you could maybe give a few more instances of that. Cause I find it so helpful where it's like, you want to give them awareness so that they can then own it, you know, understand how their body feels, what feels good for them. Are there certain ways in which parents can ask that to their child so that they can help their child become more attuned also?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. It's one I think about a lot. I mean, I think the easiest kind of, I don't want to say opposite, but certainly other type of example is kids who are overstimulated by too much noise and find it really unpleasant. So they might cover their ears and you're like, what's the big deal? Like the TV is on. You know, like, and I think the tendency of parents, I shouldn't say a tendency of some parents is to then, let's say, turn the TV softer, even though you might have a typical, you know, your sensory processing may be more typical. And so it feels quiet to you. You know that that's the volume that's appropriate for your kid. The problem with that, and it's certainly nothing I would ever say, like, don't ever do that. You know, sometimes there's a time and a place for let's adjust the environment to my kid. You know, my kid is putting their hands over their ears. My kid's had a long day. My kid is starting to yell. Things are too loud and overstimulating. Let's make it quieter. There's other times where it can be really helpful to kind of push your child's edge you know, and again, to slow it down and say, again, this is not when they're in the midst of like shrieking, right? But when they're starting to get uncomfortable with, let's say, loud noise, and they want to leave a store, let's say, or, you know, and to say, we're going to stay here a little bit more. Let's see what you can do to handle it. Right. So it's kind of, you want to validate, and this is true for so many things, you want to validate that your child's experience is real for them. Right. So it's so tempting to be, you know, like I said, with the guy that you see putting on sunglasses, you're like, how? What are you crazy? You know, it's so tempting to say, like, this store isn't even that loud. You know, like, just take your hands off your ears. It's not that loud. It's not that loud. It's like, well, obviously, it's really loud for your kid, or they wouldn't be putting their hands over their ears. So it's much, you know, more attuned to say something. I mean, and if they're just putting their hands over their ears, that's okay. That's actually a really great coping technique, and you can compliment them for that. But it's sort of, you know, it's much more attuned to say, I see this door is really loud for you. Because again, not everybody experiences sensory input the same way. I see this door is really loud for you. I get it. I see you're covering your ears. I do need to keep doing whatever I'm doing here, this errand. Let's see what we can do that might make it a little for you. You know, let's take some deep breaths. Let's, you know, hold your ears a little tighter. Let's maybe look into getting some noise canceling headphones that we can bring. And so helping your child learn that they have this sensitivity and that they need to adapt rather than always adapting the environment for them. And walking that line, I think, is really important. And it's not, there are times where it's like, I have a busy errand to run. There's no way I'm taking this kid. He's going to freak out. Absolutely, I'm keeping him home in the calm environment.
Right.
Other times where it's like, no, I haven't taken him for a while. And like, he can't learn that that's
what you got to build those muscles to do.
Exactly. So I don't know if that answers your
question. No. I think that was great. And again, I think you also modeled it. And I think whenever you model, it's incredibly helpful also. Just like literally verbalizing what is happening, because I think sometimes they don't even realize it. So you, that scenario, one, yes, you were validating, but two, you were also giving a descriptor to what was happening that they may not be able to understand in that moment. So I think that that's also incredibly helpful. And it's a tool that I use a lot too, just because particularly in the moments of toughness, it might be hard for them to realize like what in this moment is tough. And you were very clear and descriptive of saying like, it feels like this is too loud for you. You know, you have your hands over your ears. So you're like walking them through exactly what is happening and giving them the awareness of what they're doing that they may not even be aware of, or the difficulty that they may be having, while also validating it. So I think that, yes, every time you do it, I'm like, yes.
And I just want to highlight, I mean, I said this, but I think it's worth reiterating and just hammering that everyone's sensory experience is different. Mm-hmm. And how tempting it is, I mean, there's a political metaphor in here somewhere, but how tempting it is to just assume that our sensory experience is the right one. Right. It's the only one and the right one, right? So I think about smell. Both of my kids and my husband actually, I don't know if they're super smellers or whatever, you know, but like they smell things that I don't smell.
I'm a super.
And it's so tempting to be like, nothing smells, like you are being insane because I don't smell it. You're just not going to get anywhere that way, you know, with your kid, with coming up with coping strategies, with, and so again, you're also not going to get anywhere.
I'm going to pause you. I'm just going to mark this time so that Jesse, my husband, goes back and watches this part of it. It's a super smeller. I appreciate the support you're giving to us. So thank you.
And to build on coping skills, because it's also like, you know, my son will say like, something smells, we have to find it. And it's also okay to be like, no. Like, I'm not going to actually like turn this into a crisis. But it is important to say, but I do get it that for you, it really smells.
Right.
And so what can you do? Can you go into another room? Here's a tea bag that you know, with a pleasant smell. You know, at one point I got my kids, you know, oils or whatever, you know, that's,
we do hard like cinnamon sticks in our house.
Right. It's like, here's something you can smell. If the smell becomes overwhelming to you, I don't smell it. So I'm very clear with them, like, it's not that I don't believe that this is your experience. It's right. More that I'm going to help you cope with this experience because you're walking into places that are not under your control and you're having these smell things.
Yeah.
What can we do? Yeah. Carry around a cinnamon stick. Carry around a tea bag.
Yeah. It's funny. Again, as you're saying it, I'm like thinking of my own, like, because we are egocentric beings. I'm thinking of my own self. I am a super smeller. I'm a super taster. Like, this is not something I discovered until I was older, but like, my sister would always ride on me, like, Rach, you're eating such bland food. It's gross. Why? Like, what is wrong with you? You're literally eating a plain piece of chicken and rice. Like, what are you doing? How is that enjoyable to you? And I'm like, and to me, I was like, this is such a rich flavor. Like, it was just so much to me, but I didn't understand that we literally could both be eating the same thing and experiencing it in such significant ways. You know, I know people have different likes or dislikes, but the fact that like me taking a bite of food could be so drastically different from the experience she was having.
Yeah. And that's actually really helpful with kids, because one of my kids is like this, and he will, I'm just thinking, we just had Passover. So there's tasting for those who are not Jewish, who are listening. One of the things you have to do is, or you don't have to do anything, but one of the things that is a ritual is taking a piece of parsley and dipping it into salt water and then eating the whole thing. And it's not particularly pleasant, but it's not horrible to me.
Right.
Right? And so I've come to have a lot more tolerance when my younger one eats something like that, as he did at the Seder, and is like, you know, and can't handle it and like runs out to spit it in the sink. And I think at first it was sort of before I had, you know, the sensory understanding, it's like, that would be a behavioral issue. Like, you can't gag like that at the table. You can't get up and run away just because you don't let, you know, it's like suck it up and swallow it. It's not right. That bad. For him, it might be that bad. Now, he still, you know, and I have to imagine, well, imagine if someone gave me the most disgusting thing I can think of to eat and then told me I hadn't to just swallow it.
Right.
Right. And so it's, again, it's like putting yourself in your kid's shoes and then saying, okay, you still can't make that big of a show of it. However, I do understand certain things are really gross for you. Here's what I would suggest next time that we're going to work on. You know, here's a napkin. Can you spit it out quietly? You know, whatever it is. So you end up having so much more latitude to kind of work with your kids and move forward with your kids when you accept that you don't necessarily get to dictate their sensory experiences. Same goes for emotional experiences, but that's a different episode, perhaps.
Continuation, episode 2. I think it says, as you were saying it, like what came to mind for me is like almost thinking of when you see somebody who might have a more significant sensory response to it, is like, what is an extreme example for you just so that you can kind of understand it better? You know, I do think as we're able to understand it and like viscerally feel it, it's helpful for us. So oftentimes I'll go through that exercise of thinking through something, again, whichever extreme it might be, of how I would feel if, you know, you did the gloves off scenario for understanding the sensory seeker. And I thought that that was a really good one. And similarly, in the vein of the child who's the super taster, you know, if you had like the worst thing in the world imaginable for you, how does that taste? And that's kind of the response that they're having. So I think it's helpful when you're able to put yourself in their shoes, but obviously through a different experience, but just like more aggrandized. I want to be mindful of time. I could go on and on. So we will do a part 2 and we will get more into the emotional regulation, which was meant to be more of the focus, but I always derail you and we go off on tangents, but I think it's all super valuable and supportive of parenting and how, you know, just being, I think one of the key takeaways for me is just being aware of it, you know, bringing awareness to it. It doesn't mean you necessarily need to do anything. It doesn't mean you need to change anything. But just seeing it through the lens of what their experience may be and how it's different. And I'll let you verbalize that better if you would like to in your own words. But I think kind of that essence, I think, is something that all parents can walk away with. You know, we all have this unique profile. There's a spectrum across kind of all of our different senses. We kind of went into a handful of them, you know, in terms of auditory, in terms of olfactory, in terms of, you know, the visual, all these different things. And that for each person, it could be along that continuum, something very, very different, and just being understanding of that. And I think that that's very true for kids. And I also think it's very true for adults. And we maybe also weren't given the language and the understanding to see it, but being aware of it, I think, is helpful in any of your interactions. It's like, it's very helpful for me in my interactions with other grownups too, of understanding like their comfort. And again, this is also in the emotional realm of like, their comfort is different than mine. You know, I might [S2] Right. [S1] Be very comfortable with, I'm very comfortable with my kids getting super messy. I have no problem with that. You know, I know at the end we're going to clean it up. I have a plan. I have an exit strategy always if we're doing messy play. Like, we're gonna have towels, or we're gonna have a hose, we're gonna have something, like, you know, I'm prepared for it. But I know others are very opposed to that, and that's okay, you know. So I designated my home for my my social circle as being like the messy playhouse. You know, mm-hmm. you're not as comfortable with it. Like, they will literally be like, we're going over to the Podells. We're gonna bring towels. We're bringing bathing suits. We're getting messy. You know, a win for everybody. So I think also understanding it in the context of, as adults, understanding ourselves, understanding the people who are around us, and kind of being understanding through that lens, I think is really helpful. All right, we're gonna go into what I'm gonna refer to as a lightning round, but like, you can give longer answers than a quick one if it's something that warrants that. So we discussed some of the things you liked doing as a grown up, but when you were a child, what was your favorite sensory play activity? Basically, any play.
I loved jumping into leaves in the fall. Was a huge one. And also, I will never ever forget, which says something, in kindergarten we did finger painting with chocolate pudding, which met so many sensory needs in like the best way possible.
I have never done chocolate pudding finger painting with my children, so I will add that, because I love me some chocolate pudding and I'm okay with finger painting, so we'll combine it all. We tend to do a lot of toe painting, and I was actually, the first time my child named it that, I was like, yes, that is what you were doing. And he was like, very profound. Sometimes they say very profound things. And toe painting was one that like really stuck with me. I was like, yeah, we shouldn't just limit it to the fingers. Let's do toe painting too. I love that one. Okay. It's almost going to be too hard and too broad, so don't kill me and you can pass on this one. But if there was one thing you wish parents like better understood about sensory or play, what would it be?
I mean, I would say C episode. That people's sensory experiences are different, that no one sensory experience of the world is kind of real or not real. That play is foundational to learning and not something that needs to be interrupted or enhanced for learning. I'll leave it there for now.
As I said, you were going to summarize what it was much better than me, so I appreciate that and thank you. Yeah. Is there, again, you kind of alluded to the fact that like play is play, you know, like it doesn't need to be toy based. It doesn't need to be, you know, with this specific function or feature in mind. But is there a product that you love, or that you found that a majority of children love, or that both of your children loved? Is there like an item that kind of resonates with you of like, wow, this is like a perfect toy?
Blocks. I think there's a reason that they're around, especially
still
like
around, always around.
Yeah, still around, always around. I mean, like colored wooden blocks, or not even colored necessarily, I think are timeless. Any musical instruments, rain sticks or tambourines. But also, as I said, a spoon on pots are also kind of timeless. And then, you know, again, this gets into the how comfortable are you with mess? But I've never found a little kid. That's not true. Have found little kids. Many little kids really enjoy slime.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't like slime. It's like
very slime.
So I don't mind oobleck. I don't mind non-Newtonian fluids when done properly. So like a cornstarch water, I don't mind, because like I enjoy
it. I love cornstarch water. I love that.
I love that it has different like physical properties. I find fascinating. So like cause and effect there for me comes into play. I'm like, ooh, if I hit it really hard, it's going to change. For those who don't know, oobleck is a cornstarch and water combination, and sometimes acts like a solid, sometimes acts like a fluid. I think most people are familiar with oobleck. But like slime, for whatever, like it's too slimy for me. I love Play-Doh. I love
silly putty.
I don't mind silly putty. And we have like a lot of different variants of it. But yeah, it's funny. Slime is not my thing. And I think again comes back to like, I am more averse in general, and it like from a tactile perspective, it's like
this is too much.
Even as you're saying it, I'm like, ooh, this is icky. I'm literally having real time responses. You're all seeing. I can't mask well when it relates. It's funny. I can mask well when it relates to like emotional stuff, but when it relates to sensory stuff, I think because it's so visceral, I'm like, oh no. And we had, I guess we kind of just talked about it in terms of like the rain sticks and whatnot. So is there anything else you would like to leave with the audience that we did not get to talk about? And yes, we will have another episode, so I won't make you go into all of those things, but is there any kind of quick hit or something that we didn't talk about that you would like to discuss?
I don't think so. I mean, I would just, again, put a point on take it easy on yourself. You know, like there's no one right way to do this. There's no, I don't want anybody listening to this and being like, oh no, I never recognized that my kid's smell was real and I ruined. I mean, like one day at a time, take it easy on yourself. You know, whatever platitudes you want to insert here. But I think all these parenting podcasts and books and social media, I think it can be tremendously helpful, and it can unfortunately also be a force for shame and competition. And I would really like that anything that I participate in be in the former category.
Yeah, very much so. And you live by that, and you also instruct by that. And I think that it's really, it's something very basic and also foundational. You know, we're talking about play as being foundational, but I think, again, like we're all doing our best. You know, I think, you know, particularly the people who are listening to this are our parents who care, who are trying. And that doesn't mean that every moment is going to be perfect. It doesn't mean you need to be doing all the things all the time. I highly recommend everybody follow Dr. Hirschberg on Instagram, because every weekend when you give the weekend reminder or you give the holiday reminder, I'm like, yes, preach. More of this, more of this. For those who don't yet follow you, also know that you're having a profound impact on me, and I know, you know, thousands of other people. Kind of the mentality of like, if you do nothing, it's okay. You know, and if you don't get to all the things, it's okay, or whatever it might be, said much more beautifully and articulately. But again, like, it's not just, it's not a platitude for you. It's something that you like, you believe in. And I think that you provide so much help and support for people to feel better about it. You know what I mean? And we should all, like, what you're seeing is not always real. It's not, you know, every single moment of somebody's day, you're seeing this like beautiful snapshot on, you know, on Instagram or whatever it might be. So did we just date ourselves again? I don't know, on TikTok, on wherever it might be. But yes, I highly, highly 5-star recommend following your Instagram. So thank you. Thank you again so much for being here. I've known you now for a while, and every single time I speak to you, I learn, I feel better, I feel lighter. I also have kind of reminders to myself of things that I can be doing, that I want to be doing, but that it's helpful to hear. And you always kind of say it in such a simple and tangible way. So I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. This was such a treat. I appreciate it. Bye.